This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. Learn about the Fair Kitchens Code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
Now streaming from HRN, this is The Feed Feed. I'm Jake Cohen, editorial director of The Feed Feed, the world's largest crowdsourced food publication and social media community, serving as your daily source of what to cook, bake, and drink. Occasionally joined by our co-founders, Julie and Dan Resnick, we sit down with leaders and upstarts of the food media realm.
So we often say that we're, as Feed Feed, answering this sort of age-old question, which is, what do we eat for fill-in-the-blank, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Our approach to doing so involves lifting up voices from culinary content creators all over the world, no matter how big or small their following is. This podcast takes the democratization of food media one step further by giving a behind-the-scenes look of the epicurean magazines, websites, videos, and accounts you digest every day. We'll discuss everything from breaking into the industry, navigating social media.
That's been my bigger social media thing, is like, I think like I just get bored very quickly. And even when things are working really well, I'm like, everyone's doing this. I don't want to do this anymore.
Building and growing a community.
People are like, why is it five E's? And I'm like, I don't know. When you say eats, how many E's does that feel like it sounds like? And that's why. No real good rhyme or reason to any of it, but that's also kind of been our style this whole time.
And producing content that resonates with young and old.
You know, if someone doesn't like my writing or the photographs of my book or the design, that's subjective. But if I see that a recipe didn't work, then I really failed someone.
So whether you want to know what goes into food styling a magazine cover, the process of getting a cookbook deal, understanding what the hell TikTok is, or grasping how a recipe can go viral.
I mean, I guess the thing about going viral too is that then it's out there and people start claiming it as their own. And that's happened a few times recently with that tart, which is sort of depressing.
But drag them. Name names.
I'm not naming any names, but you know who you are.
We'll be covering it all. This is the Feed Feed Podcast. Subscribe to the Feed Feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast, the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome culinary historian and host and producer of the long-running podcast, A Taste of the Past, Linda Palacio. In this episode, we'll talk to Linda about why culinary history matters, insights from a podcasting veteran, and we'll hear Linda's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Still contemplating joining us for the fabulous food and wine events and great company on the American Riviera? Don't wait too long, as tickets are already selling fast for this year's Santa Barbara Culinary Experience, March 13 to 15, 2020. 3+ days of unique only in Santa Barbara events, including cooking demonstrations, wine tastings, culinary talks, workshops, and classes, farm tours, guided farmers markets visits, as well as special meals from top chefs like Mary Sue Milliken, Susan Feniger, Ludo Lefebvre, and Chris Bianco, and dinners at Santa Barbara's hottest dining spots like The Lark and BBG. Go to sbce.events to check out the lineup and purchase tickets. You'll even have the chance to attend a live Inside Julia's Kitchen taping. Special hotel rates are on offer until mid-February. Don't miss out, as I'd really love to see you there. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. If you're a Julia fan or a regular listener, you know that Julia cared about culinary history. It's baked right into the foundation that she created. In calling it the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts, Julia intended the foundation to explore what mattered to her, rather than be a monument to her achievements. Now, while neither gastronomy nor the culinary arts are specifically about history, they are both about studying and education. And as we know, Julia was a consummate student. It was really her deep curiosity that drove much of her success. She wanted to learn all about the why and the how, which leads us on to traditions. And what are traditions other than elements of history? If you're asking, where does a recipe originally come from, you're headed to your bookshelf, or more likely online. Regardless, this is food history. What's the origin of tarte tatin? Well, that brings you to a little hotel in France, and then into the reasons why French people might have been stopping there. What's the connection between James Bond and broccoli? Well, there is one. Google it. My point is, we've just explored culinary history. Someone who knows quite a lot about culinary history and how you marry up the past with its relevance for today is Linda Palacio. Linda is a culinary historian well known for hosting and producing another Heritage Radio Network podcast, A Taste of the Past, one of its longest-running programs. Started in 2009, very early days in the history of podcasting, A Taste of the Past joins up food, culture, and history through Linda's interviews with authors, historians, and food scholars on topics as diverse as what they ate in ancient Egypt to today's American culinary landscape. Linda began her career as a writer and producer in the nascent days of the Food Network. She has also been the program director for the Culinary Historians of New York. That's where we first met Linda, as the foundation happily supports the Culinary Historians of New York's grant program for culinary history research. Linda is also a member of the New York chapter of Les Dames d'Escoffier, whose legacy awards we profiled in last week's episode 75. She joins us today to give us a taste of the past and talk about why culinary history is important, endlessly fascinating, and fun. Welcome to the podcast, Linda.
Thanks so much for having me, Todd. That was a great setup, by the way. I loved it. I mean, Julia, pretty much your words of Julia's pretty much stated why culinary history is so important.
Well, you're jumping ahead. So let's go back in history, because I'd like to know, just because I'm sort of in awe of how long your podcast has been running, which, you know, in the life of history is short time, but in the life of podcasting is an eternity. And so yeah. I wanted to start at the beginning, like what led you to start a podcast, and why did you pick culinary history, or was it sort of the other way around?
It was the other way around. Interesting that, yeah, that you caught that, because I've always been a culinary historian. Well, not always, but that's been my job, my interest, and that was always there. There was no, but it's interesting because there's no way, no forum to get that information out to a lot of people. Aha. A podcast, all right? So Patrick Martin started the Heritage Radio Network, and I know at that time in 2009, a few months before I came along, and I asked him, did he need another show, and did he have some space? And I pitched him the idea, and he said, yeah, can you start tomorrow? So that was that.
So it sounds like it was like the perfect marriage, that because yeah. culinary history is maybe more of a niche subject, the fact that podcasting, you can be as completely niche as you want to and find an audience, was like a perfect marriage?
I mean, it's turned out that way. I mean, I had no idea whether anyone was listening or not, but I was having a good time learning things and exploring different topics. And then it turns out to be, you know, rather popular with, you know, all kinds of ages. So I'm very pleased about the whole outcome. And it's, yes, been a long marriage, a good one.
Yeah, and I was really struck by, you know, you're coming up, you're not quite there, but you're close enough. I think we can round up to 350 episodes. And so what have you found now that you know that people are listening? I mean, I know that you were noted as the top 100 podcast in the Times newspaper in the UK, all the way in the UK, which is amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What do you think, or what have you learned, has made A Taste of the Past resonate?
That I am still trying to figure out. I don't know whether it's the variety of topics. You mentioned that, you know, I'm just coming up on 350 episodes, or I think I just did a 350th, or you are, I don't know. Well, check it out. And you'd think, well, over 10 years, if it's weekly, I'd have a lot more. No, I'm pretty... I'm pretty liberal about my time off and about choosing the right topic. If I don't have a topic I'm really interested in or found a person, a really good person who can speak to that topic, I just don't do a show. It has to be a well-developed idea for me to have a show. So there are many weeks that get skipped. And as I said, it's a real variety of topics. I mean, I'll jump from one era in history to another era in history and modern day things, and then some maybe books, popular books that are just out that have an element of food history in them that I think is relevant to talk about. So it's a real mashup of topics, and I guess it works.
Well, and I guess an example of how culinary history, I think many times people hear that and they think about, you know, the long ago past or really deep historical topics, but kind of what your show represents is it can be that or it can be something very present, no?
That's right. I mean, I always say, you know, whatever you ate yesterday or this afternoon, you know, before, that's now history. And how, you know, looking at right now in different towns, what types of foods people are interested in, what type of restaurants are opening, it tells us so much about immigration, cooking methods, you know, just the whole gamut.
Yeah, I thought to be more specific, I just listened to your episode which you could say it was about Zagat or you could say it about infatuation, and the infatuation is this new review site, right? But they're, well, I'll let you say what they're doing with Zagat, and you were sort of covering the here and now and the new of what they're doing, but then giving this reflection of the history of what had been a very important part of, you know, restaurant reviews in America.
That's right. I mean, you mentioned, you know, somebody wants to find out what something in food, they'll most likely not go to their bookshelves, they'll go to the internet. And the same happens. I mean, there's everything available now. Restaurant reviews, book reviews, but then you sort of have to be careful, you know, like who those sources are online. They're not always vetted. And then you have somebody like, you know, like Infatuation or a Zagat, and it's a trusted name, a trusted site. That was what came about early on in book form with these people. And it was peer reviewed. People who went to the restaurants gave their opinions. It wasn't just somebody out of the blue, you know, writing it. And it was, I think that that's interesting to note. Sources for studying anything, especially culinary history. There's a lot of bad information on the internet. Just a little warning out there. Not bad information, incorrect information.
Well, it's also like you just made me think that I was trying to think, I loved Zagat, and I really missed it when Google essentially dismantled it. But one of the key differences, I think, right, is that when you go to Yelp, and I find Yelp helpful, but there's a tendency on the internet for people to use it more for venting than for complimenting. Mm-hmm. And so skewed, a lot of stuff is skewed, particularly the stuff that's all crowdsourced from people complaining. And usually if you have 1,000, it still nets out well. But the great thing about Zagat is the way that it was curated was not focused on complaints.
Right, that's right. And I mean, not just anyone could write in. I mean, those opinions were, as you said, they were vetted and then they were put together, and then their own editors would go and people working for them to go and check it out and, you know, double check it and verify it. Yeah, it was and is a great tome. It's also a great phone book too when you're in a hurry and you want to find, you know, the location and the address and then read a little something about it. And it just had all the right elements going on.
Well, we look forward to seeing what the Infatuation does with that. So you were saying bit about how you curate your own show. And has that been something that really evolved from the first, like when you first started? Did you try to fill every week no matter what, or you've always kind of felt the selectivity? So I was just curious, have you evolved a lot in the process, or it's pretty much very similar to how the original conception?
I think it stayed pretty original. I mean, you go back and listen to some of the earliest broadcasts, and It was, yeah, early on I tried to, you know, it was new. I wanted to, I felt this obligation to have a show every week. But then I realized if, you know, if it wasn't right, it wasn't going to work. So it stayed pretty much the same. I search a topic. And as I say, because each show is so, we were talking before we went on the air, that each one of my shows is very research heavy for me. I don't go into it unless, because I can't, as a culinary historian, I have some specialties that I've studied over the years, but I can't possibly know everything about every topic in culinary history. But I'm interested in them, and I love to learn new things. So if I'm not prepared and try to learn and know as much as I can about a topic so that I can talk to the person about it intelligently and not, you know, ask stupid questions, for better or for worse, I spend a lot of time learning about each topic, and sometimes I'm just not ready, you know, to do that topic. So it's stayed, and that's been that way from the very beginning.
Well, it takes a lot of prescience to know, you know, where you're comfortable and what should guide you. So given this tenure, why do you think, I mean, and we haven't sort of covered this yet, but there's this kind of supposition that culinary history as a legitimate, if you will, topic is new or new-ish or is just coming in
it is.
To its own. But obviously you've been doing it a long time.
Yeah, but you've really hit on something and you're absolutely correct, especially, and I can really talk to that, having been of a particular age. There was no way to study food history, or specifically culinary history, back in the day, like when I was in school, you had to find probably a mentor or faculty member who was willing to go with you a little bit. Universities, schools did not consider the study academic enough, just like food writing, especially food writing. It was not deemed an academic pursuit in any faculty or department of study. So one kind of ended up cobbling together a method of studying it to no specific end at school, but, you know, just for me, for my own edification. And that would generally lead me to anthropology, nutritional anthropology, history, obviously. You know, you can, believe it or not, glean a lot from historic texts that not much attention was usually given to the food. Art history, and there you have to be a little careful too, because the art's not always, you know, somebody wanted a pineapple in the painting, but pineapples didn't exist in that country in that era, so, but it was there. But you can, I mean, old tapestries and works of art where they really had to put things in that they knew and saw, you can learn a lot from a lot of these old, very old, ancient paintings and tapestries. So art history would be another form, although I caution someone just to think that art history alone can tell you what food was on the table. At any rate, that was to speak to the fact that there was no faculty of food studies. There was no, you know, specific path to follow. So those of us who were interested sort of had to do it ourselves and follow it ourselves. And then in the 1970s, and thanks to Julia Child and Jacques Pepin, they started the food studies program at Boston University. Mm. And that was a real game changer. Mm. Because soon after that, what followed were food studies programs and I think now you can find them practically at every major university, and a lot of smaller universities that, you know, do more specialty studies. NYU followed on their heels, and they have a wonderful department. And that covers everything from actual food studies, foodways, but a lot of food history is involved in that, and culinary history. Now, so, you know, we say, well, what's the difference of between food history and culinary history? There used to be a line, a very definite line, and academics would always fall on the side of food history because you were looking at the provenance of a food substance, the place, the agriculture, the you know, everything about the food. And then culinary history kind of studied more about the food and the foodstuffs, how it was used, the equipment used to cook it, the presentation on the table, you know, the crockery, the introduction of utensils, you know, all kinds of different things that really were, it was a social studies program. You were learning about societies. And this is ultimately, so this line became very blurred. And now, you know, culinary history has more come into its own because people realize that you can't study a culture without knowing what they ate. And knowing what they ate means, well, who did the cooking? And how was it cooked? And how was it eaten? Where was it presented? And it just blossomed. And now, since the 70s, it has grown exponentially, I think, in the numbers of people who are studying it and interested in it. Why? The big question is why. You know, we've come of age in this, in America, certainly, and I would venture to say in a lot of other countries, although France and Italy in particular, and Western Europe, were always very concerned about their food, but America, we were very young. We really didn't give much other than, you know, growing it with the farmers, and then there was a lot of that was important. But we've become more aware of food and where it comes from, you know, and what we eat. And I think all of this awareness about food certainly plays large in people becoming interested in then the history in the background.
Well, that just struck me. Do you think there's also something of, we've lived through one of the longest ages now where there's not been a scarcity of food, you know, particularly for the wealthier countries? And do you think that the when you don't have to be preoccupied where your food source is going to come from, that gives right. you more room to think intellectually about it?
I think that's a very good possibility. I mean, we talk because what we talk about in about the foods during times of deprivation, you know, war times and things, you know, like in Italy, particularly the cucina povera, how many dishes were based on that. We look at it from afar and we look at it, you know, decades afterwards. And so I think you're right that it's because we're not out there scraping together and scrambling around to find balanced meals that we can just talk about the foodstuffs and the food ways and where did this food come from and I think we have a lot more liberty of studies.
Well, obviously at the foundation we like the idea that you think that the BU's gastronomy program that Julia and Jacques Pepin teamed up to help found was kind of a tipping point. But it's interesting because I know what you mean about, you know, obviously France has a long tradition in Italy of being more interested in food, although there mm-hmm. seems to be academic and history stuff to an extent, but then the UK has a long history, and I think the UK has had the same kind of trajectories in the US for where culinary history was not considered academic or appropriate, or food writing wasn't a real career until, like you said, mm-hmm. in the 70s. And so, you know, I agree with you about America being young, but you see the same sort of dismissiveness, or you saw the same dismissiveness in the UK, which had a much longer history, no?
Yeah, which would play to your point about the fact that they have the leisure to look at food and not just try to find their food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was really struck this comment that has been sitting with me when speaking to my mother-in-law, the food writer Ann Willen, who you know, and Ann said to me this just offhand comment about, you know, when I was a child, chicken was a delicacy. You didn't have chicken very often. And I'm thinking, what? Because chicken is so ubiquitous now. But that's a pretty short period of time where it went from, you know, a rare staple to something that everybody takes for granted, at least in the Western world.
Right. And it's interesting. And then how the chicken industry grew, and there were, you know, too many chickens, and then there was disease. And oh, man, there have been some interesting shows that I've covered on chickens. And yeah, it used to be something that was so easy to just, if you had some property, you had a couple of chickens, right? And they would give you eggs. And then when they got old, you had an extra rooster, one would go in the pot. that all changed, of course. Yeah, the whole Industrial Revolution, I think, and the concentration of populations in cities, which boomed, you know, every wartime post-wartime sees a boom in populations in cities. And so the industrialization of foodstuffs came along, you know, the mechanization of mass production. And that changed everything, everything from, you know, to a lot of livestock and chickens included in not only just vegetables and other forms of food.
Well, and that ties into what you said about the sort of the BU gastronomy program and that the 70s being that maybe tipping point also with the mechanization, industrialization of food where it really like cranked up and the technology met the theories. And so that all kind of, that also emphasized the interest because as people became more concerned, they became more interested, thus legitimizing the study of it a bit more too. Okay, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back to talk memorable moments from A Taste of the Past with Linda Palacio. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Fair Kitchens. The food service industry faces a challenge. More people are eating out, yet restaurants are losing talent. Why is this? Research by Fair Kitchens reveals a serious well-being issue within professional kitchens. 74% of chefs are sleep deprived to the point of exhaustion. 63% of chefs feel depressed, and more than half feel pushed to the breaking point. This can't be ignored. Fair Kitchens is a movement based on the belief that a positive kitchen culture makes for a healthier business. By taking the pledge to be a Fair Kitchen, they'll provide you with free information, tools, and resources to help you take action towards making your restaurant more stable, productive, and happy, which positively affects the guest experience. It's time to act now. Learn about the Fair Kitchens code and join the movement at fairkitchens.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to culinary historian Linda Palacio about hosting and producing Heritage Radio Network's own A Taste of the Past podcast. So, Linda, I know this is challenging because it's almost hard to think back 350 episodes, but what are, do you have some memorable moments or favorite guests that, that do stand out or really stuck with you?
You know, as soon as I go home, I'm going to, after doing this interview with you, I'm going to think about, oh, I should have mentioned so-and-so. It's a little akin to that question, like, you know, choose your favorite child. I mean, each one of them were very memorable to me because they're so much, I learned so much from each show. But I think things that sort of stand out with me are, And they run from new to old. Certainly, my having Sally Granger on the show here. Sally is a very well known food historian and recreator of dishes and from the UK, and she has done an extensive study on garum, the liquamen, the you know, the seasoning that was used throughout the ancient Roman period and onward, and. She's just so knowledgeable and learning so much about the food, and ancient Roman history happens to be one of my favorite periods. Another one that,
what's one of your favorite things about ancient Roman culinary history?
I guess how sophisticated the dishes were. How sophisticated a lot of their agricultural methods were. I mean, you know, there were people who, you know, the wealthy, who had, of course, their homes in the country, outside of the city of the empire of Rome. In the country, and they wanted fish. They wanted fresh fish on their plate, so they had the ingenuity. I mean, you think about the aqueducts in Rome. I mean, how advanced, what engineers they were. In building cities. Well, they decided, well, if we can build these aqueducts, why couldn't we build channels and have the fresh fish float up and have fresh fish on our plate when we wanted it. Because there was no fast means of travel. How are they only going to get there in a chariot? Right? It's going to take them a long time to get that fish on
a Just Eats fish delivery chariot.
Right, right. I just found that fascinating, that, you know, that so much attention and ingenuity would go into that. And now this was just their country home. This was not their, you know, their city abode. And I thought that, you know, but also the sophistication of the flavors, and the spice trade was, you know, was growing by leaps and bounds. So the flavors in the dishes were very intense and very different, you know, and I, cooking methods were also very interesting, from almost what I can say, like stir frying to baking in the ovens they had wonderful ovens. And I guess it just intrigues me because it was so sophisticated.
Well, and I think that combination, right, of how advanced the civilization was for how long ago it also was, and that you, especially as things have evolved or knowledge was lost or not duplicated, it is always, I think, extraordinary to look at Roman civilization.
Yeah, a lot of those fish channels, I'm sure, weren't duplicated in too many places. But
and is that one? Were they some of the first canal builders then, or this was sort of different?
I think this was different. They were. I think these had to have been the houses that were out of the city, but not that far out that they couldn't. That this could was conceivable.
Mm.
So were they the first canal buildings? Well, I don't know. But no, I mean, they're probably. And yet I'm thinking of other countries and areas of the world that where canals were very important.
Yeah, they must have had them in Mesopotamia and places like that.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, for a city, for a culture to thrive, had to be built next to a water source, the ocean, rivers, you know, lakes. Otherwise, the culture would die out. So, water was very important.
So, from ancient Rome, where else have you been taken that really you've loved going?
Just throwing in. I'm not going to go, you know, in detail too much, but I loved learning about the history of refrigeration.
that is not what I expected you to say, but okay, let's go there.
All right. I mean, that's what I was saying.
I've said at the beginning of the podcast that culinary history is endlessly fascinating. So what is endlessly fascinating about the history of refrigeration?
and I'm blanking on the professor's name at this time, but he wrote a wonderful book. It's called, I think, just Refrigeration. But, you think about how we existed, how we kept foods fresh. I mean, we went back a ways on talking about it, and he did. There were chunks of ice. Well, how did you get chunks of ice in there? So there were ice ponds, there were ice houses, and, you know, we started at the very beginning of keeping things cold, you know, burying things, burying some ice, and ice was, you know, was hard to come by in a lot of places because the temperature was just never that cold.
Oh, I get it. So you're talking about the whole, I was thinking refrigeration of like mechanized, but you're talking about how any, because I do find that fascinating, like how they lugged.
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, his specialty was, yes, the machinery and the mechanization of refrigeration. But in order to explain why this was important, he had to look back.
Mm.
And that's what culinary history is. I mean, you can't just talk about something, you know, in a vacuum at its present time without looking, well, where did we come from? It's all like this whole, 23andMe, you know, the DNA studies of, you know, where did I come from? Well, the same thing with food.
Mm.
You got to look back to, you know, to where did it all come from and why? Why did we need a refrigerator? Why did we need refrigeration? I found that very fascinating.
Well, I want to know what you learned about ice houses, because I still have a really hard time. It's even that movie Frozen where they're like harvesting the ice. But obviously they did that because things like ice cream and granita and things have existed for longer than modern refrigeration. But obviously.
And that's right.
Right. I've always been like amazed that ice houses worked.
Yeah, and they had a lot of different forms of them. And problem with doing these shows is I've forgotten as much as I've learned. I mean, can't keep everything in the top of my head. But the ice houses were very amazing. It's like insulation. If you pack enough stuff around ice, it will hold for a lot longer than just putting an ice cube on the table. You know, So different things would be used to pack around it to keep it cold. And then there were methods of burying it too. And, you know, and just like making charcoal, I was thinking also about making charcoal. But don't, you know, you're getting me thinking about a lot of other things. See, one thing always leads to another, and that's how I form my shows.
Well, but, and yeah, and I know I'm really challenging you to, like, pick amongst your children, and there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Maybe if we change the way we think about it, are there, just as you were talking about, that was memorable to you because you find the refrigeration topic fascinating and have lots of cool rabbit holes. What are there other things that you really surprised you or really changed your own perspective just from doing the episode and having the guest on?
Yes. You know how salt all of a sudden has become this hot commodity? Mm. It always was a commodity. It was, you know, you know, in the early, just pre-Renaissance times, I mean, a salt cellar was a very special thing made by the top silversmith, and an important guest was seated above the salt, mm-hmm. or below the salt. I mean, that, you know, so salt had an exalted place at the table. Of course it did. We can't exist without salt. And so now salt, we have all these sea salts, you know, we went through the whole period of iodized salts and salt mines, you know, that originally, of course, come from oceans, you know, because they're down in underground, but you know, we're all about fancy sea salts now. And then I ran across this this woman and her brother or cousin, the Dickinsons, who have a salt works in the Appalachian Mountains, and they found it was something that existed for a couple of centuries in their family. But then it kind of fell, the salt pumping, you know, went fallow. It is an ancient lake, or an ancient sea, and I don't remember the name of the sea at this time, but then it became part of another larger ocean complex. And we're talking, you know, way underground, way in the bottom of the mountains and underneath. And this ancient sea was discovered by, I guess, you know, dripping and drilling. And big cedar trees were used to tap down into these big wells and holes that they would drill. And they would pull up very, very salty water that had been just trapped underground in these, you know, these mountain areas. And this family, as I say, hundreds for a couple of generations had been digging it up and drying it, and that was their salt. And this chef, she was a former chef, and her cousin and her brother bought the rights to they didn't own the farm anymore, but they bought the rights, or it was in the family, but cousins owned it. That's what it was. They bought the rights to drilling, or the, you know, to the, where the mine was, and they have resurrected these salt works from this ancient sea, and then they built these. The only thing I can liken them to is like a farming hoop house. So they constructed these giant hoop houses that would let the sun through, and they just put this salty, you know, strained, like panning for gold, you know, the panned. Salt out of it and put it in these hoop houses and go and stir it every day with their hands and dry it out, and it becomes this incredible salt. And I have tasted it, and it's really, and you can buy it online, J.Q. Dickinson's. And it's it has a different flavor, it has a different crystal, a different shape, and it's, to me, that was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, there are so many fascinating elements of who knew you could have a salt mine in the middle of Appalachia, and who knew that you could drill into the ground to an ancient seabed and pull it out. Because I was imagining when you first started talking about it that it was like a mine and you would get the salt like golden chunks and then you would break it up. But
no,
actually,
no, we're talking still in water.
Yeah, well, I guess that's an idea. If you have a country property or live more remotely and you drill a well and it's salty, you don't have to fret. You can start a salt mine.
Right. Well, now they knew because this had been done for, you know, as I say, a couple hundred years. And then she did research and found out the sea, where the sea was and when it went, you know, when it, I guess in the Ice Age or whatever, when, you know, the plates of the continents moved together, it was no longer, you know, a self-existing sea, and it got trapped underground. And I found that fascinating.
No, that is fascinating.
I'm fascinated by rather esoteric things from time to time, but also just cultures. Learning about a culture that I had no knowledge of, something I'm working on now, because Korean food is so popular, and I'm doing research now on Korean food and the history of the Korean foods. But, you know, it's interesting. You can find a topic that interests you and study it and learn more about it. Finding the person to speak to about it is a challenge. And my show is an interview show, like your show is. It's no good for me to just sit on the air and have a monologue that will probably put people to sleep. But I love that interaction with another person who knows, who has deep knowledge about their topic. And I just, like, it's very selfish too. I love to learn from them, and I do.
Mm. So on that note, so are you still on the hunt? I was going to ask you about either the ones that got away or the people that you would love to have on that maybe you haven't asked them yet, or they're being coy, or are you looking for a Korean food expert? Who's on your must-have list?
My must-have list is always whatever topic I'm interested in at the time. And I can't say that there are ones who got away. It's going to be, I hate to give sort of a non-answer to an answer. I would love people from history. If I could get Bartolomeo Scappi on and talk to him, I would be, thrilled. Or Mezzi Bugo, or Apicius. But I mean, even more recent, Ada Boni, who, she wrote the Talisman de Felicità. It was the Bible for a lot of Italians during around the war, post-war period, immediate post-war period, prior to that, her first edition, I'm forgetting when the first edition came out. But she was really responsible for kind of introducing pasta in various forms to different areas of Italy. You know, it was basically, for a large part, a southern construct, because you needed wheat, you needed milled flour. And I just did a show with the creator of the Pasta Grannies. It's mm-hmm. a huge YouTube channel hit. And we were talking about how now pasta is where it used to be polenta and beans, and in the north you didn't really have, they ate rice, they didn't really eat a lot of pasta. Their hard wheat was not, conducive to making pasta. And then, of course, over the years, that changed. And Ada Boni, the food writer, and she really was instrumental in helping introduce pasta to other parts of Italy.
Well, and that's what I always think that I like to blow people's mind with if they're not particularly knowledgeable about culinary history, is so many things that are associated with quintessential Italian food. Pasta, tomato sauce. Those are things that are actually relatively recent in the history of Italy. So, these things that seem so eternal are very evolutionary and not eternal.
That's right. That's right. And a lot of the shows do, inevitably we'll have to do a little separation about, wait a minute, that's a New World food, that came after the Americas were discovered, because that's, like tomatoes, as you mentioned, and potatoes. And yet so many different cuisines are based on around that. So it's interesting because it shows how cultures easily embrace new things. Do we need to... I'm very happy that a lot of these dishes, culinary historians are, documenting a lot of these dishes. We don't want to lose those. We don't want to forget about those. But at the same time, a lot of cuisines are evolving and no longer prepare those particular dishes, but we've embraced new foods. I mean, who knew that this culture would be so enamored with ramen or pho, right? This culture, I'm talking about Western cultures, you know, in America or the UK. And, you know, and that's kind of it has a real seat at the table in our cuisine now. And then, so now generations will write about it, and that will be part of what they'll write about.
Well, I think that's a good way to bring us full circle. We're going to be right back. So do you think learning about culinary history informs the present? What are your favorite milestones in culinary history? Send us an email or even a voice memo to contact@JuliaChildFoundation.org and let us know. After the break, Linda's going to reveal her Julia moment. We'll be right back.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory moment or how she's inspired them in their career. Okay, Linda, what's your Julia moment?
I had to pick one in particular because there were a couple. And then just what I loved about Julia was that she was so, talking about embracing new things, I mean, she was so welcoming and encouraging to anyone who came, you know, in her path. But the one that one of the latest memories was, after I was at the Food Network, with a group of people, we started a website, Everyday Kitchen, and then from that we decided to do, or we didn't, someone else decided to do a radio show that would help drive traffic to the website. And we had all been together at the Food Network. We all had met Julia many times, and I was the executive producer of this radio show, Monday through Friday for 2 hours.
Ooh.
It was a 2 hour show. Yeah. I produced it. This was in 2000. So I produced it from my fax machine and my office to people who were, you know, were elsewhere. Anyway, the point is we had to get people's attention. It was only in a few markets. It wasn't the Boston market, however. It was a terrestrial radio station, a regular radio station, and it played in really strange communities and cities, not in New York City where we were all located. So we figured we needed a really big splash to we had a woman and a man who interviewed different people in the food industry and chefs and food writers and talked about dishes. And well, who else to kick off the beginning of a new radio show but Julia Child? And I said, I'll call her. You know, we all had incredible Rolodexes. And yes, they were actual paper Rolodexes in those days. So I gave a call, and Stephanie Hirsch had been her longtime assistant at that time. And I called her, and I'd met her several times. And I said, hi, Stephanie. And I said, we were wondering if, you know, Julia would be available to be on the air with our host and talk about, you know, food, whatever. I forget what the topic was. And she said, well, hold on just a minute. And next thing I know, it's like, oh, hello, dear. and I asked her the question. It was Julia. And who would ever expect that you call, you know, even the people of minor importance, you would only get through to their publicist or, you know, their assistants. But Julia was on the phone and she just wanted to talk directly. And that was so something that was so indicative of her style. She was very hands-on and so personal about her contacts and her work. And I asked her the question and she said, oh, I think that sounds like it would be fun. Of course I'll do it. I don't think I ever heard her say no. And that to me, she was just so open and so welcoming. And that's something that I try to remember, is to always be positive and always be, it doesn't always work, and always try to be accepting and welcoming to new adventures. And that was something that she certainly was representative of.
And I think that is lovely and a great way to do your Julia moment. So thank you very much.
And here I am back in radio.
Yeah, there you are. Well, it was that encouragement from her accessibility and willingness to try new things that's led you to 350 episodes.
There you go.
Well, thanks for coming on our show.
Thank you so much for having me, Todd. It was a real pleasure and an honor too.
Thank you very much. And thanks everyone for listening. So Linda Palacio's podcast is A Taste of the Past, also on our own Heritage Radio Network. The new season has just begun, or you have almost 350 episodes to catch up on. Pick the ones that sound most interesting to you, or have a real binge session. Search for it wherever you find your podcasts, or go to heritageradionetwork.org and search A Taste of the Past. If you want to stay up to date with Linda, she's at Linda Palacio. It's PELACCIO. On Instagram and Twitter, and at Linda Cook Palacio on Facebook. Tell your friends to find out more about the foundation by following us at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T Shulkin, TSCHULKIN on Twitter. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer of the foundation, Lauren Selkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Amanda Wang. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Veltorni. Please give us a review. It really does help listeners discover the show. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. Downloads available soon after, wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.